Hi, Katie here, just hopping on quick before the episode to remind you I am co-leading a pilgrimage to Ireland this coming October 2024. Come join me and Christy Eisinger on a magical tour through the Emerald Isle, Our Lady of Knock, St. Patrick's Holy Mountain, the Rock of Cashel, the Cliffs of Moher, ancient monasteries, high tea at a castle, traditional music, sheep herding demonstrations, a literary pub crawl. This trip has it all, and we've made sure to keep a pace that is both adventurous and relaxing, with time to explore on your own, make new friends, pray, eat, and travel carefree with the expert local guides provided by Select International. Check out the show notes to download the brochure and sign up today. Sláinte!
Hi, I'm Katie Marquette, and you're listening to Born of Wonder.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
The mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.
When you consider things like the stars, our affairs don't seem to matter very much, do they? Virginia Woolf. Studying the universe, finding that truth, is an act of worship. Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI. Hello and welcome to Born of Wonder. I'm Katie Marquette, and on this podcast, we explore everything and anything that inspires wonder and awe in the world. Happy 100th episode, one day late. Typical, you know, to have the 100th episode, you know, a great milestone, and then not be able to get it out on time. But that sort of just sums up what this whole project is about, which is about, you know, staying sort of engaged in these artistic, literary, theological things that inspire me and hopefully inspire you in the midst of the wonderful chaos of work and family life and all those other things. So sometimes that has to take precedent, as well as, you know, sleep, catching up on sleep, other things like that. And so here we are. But this is going to be a really fun episode, I hope. It's going to be a tour through space. We're going to get galactic here for the 100th episode. I thought that was, you know, grand enough. So I've been very inspired. My older daughter turned 3 over the weekend. Very, very exciting. Very proud of her. I'm a very proud mom. And one of her gifts was one of these story orchestra books, which I've talked about before, where it'll be like a little story mixed with like a classical piece of music, like a orchestral suite or something like that. So we, for her first birthday, she got Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Since then, for her second birthday, she got Carnival of the Animals. For Christmas, she got The Nutcracker. And for her third birthday, she got The Planets by Gustav Holst, which is a orchestral suite, seven movements, written between 1914 and 1917. And it's super fun because it's like a tour of the planets, right? A tour through space. So it's very exciting. So this afternoon, we were pretending to be astronauts, you know, and our cat was an astronaut cat, because there's a cat in the book who's an astronaut. And yeah, it's lots of fun. It's been a little hard to explain that we can't actually be astronauts, but that's the wonderful thing, right, about childhood, is that line between the imaginary world and the real world is really, really thin. And you know, why not? Why can't we just go to space? You know, these kids in the book, they're in their bunk beds, suddenly they're out in space. So I hope that we can sort of feel that sense of possibility, that sense of wonder, thinking about the stars, thinking about the planets today. So I'm going to take you through this whole orchestral suite. I'll play selections from the different movements, and I also give you some really cool facts about the planets as we go through them. So hopefully that will be a lot of fun. I had fun researching it. And actually, this whole thing, you know, the fact that this was inspired by this book that I got for my daughter, it totally fits in with my whole sort of thing with Born of Wonder, what I've discovered doing this in the midst of having little kids and having a family, is that, you know, when you really just need to bring the right lens to things, and that having that lens of sort of looking, being on the lookout for things that inspire wonder, inspire awe, can transform very what would seem mundane things, you know, especially if you're in a season of little kids, you can be spending a lot of time, like, you know, stacking blocks or dealing with a baby with a sleep regression or something like that. But all those moments have so much profundity in them. You know, that afternoon in the rocking chair with the baby has lots of opportunities there for you to think about. You know, I've said before how Jewish people, the Orthodox Jews, consider rocking, they rock while they pray, to be like a flickering candle. And so you think about rocking a baby, that's a prayer, you know, rocking a baby is a prayer. So there are all these sort of moments that can be infused with grandiosity, because life is actually very grand in all those small moments. So here's a book that I'm reading with my daughter, and it gives me an opportunity then to suddenly be thinking all about space and our place in it and everything like that. So I've always loved looking at the stars and like that. I think that's like the origin of, you know, so much of my theological questioning and things like that, is just sort of, yeah, just like looking up and wondering about our place in all of things, right? And it never made me feel insignificant. It actually made me feel like we were part of something very big. And I did a whole episode all about stargazing and, you know, the constellations and sort of what that can bring us, that, you know, doing that frequently, going out and, you know, learning the stars and learning where they are in the different seasons and things like that, and artistic possibilities there as well. I'll link to that episode in the show notes if you want to continue on the theme. But yeah, I was looking up some things, you know, about space, about sort of faith and theology, and he's actually quite a popular speaker and writer, Guy Consolmagno. He is he's a research astronomer, a physicist, he's a religious brother, and he is the director of the Vatican Observatory and the president of the Vatican Observatory Foundation. So that's pretty cool. But here's a quote from him. He said, "For what it's worth, in my experience, astronomers are more likely than biologists to be believers. But several surveys, more scientific than my anecdotal experiences, have confirmed that in academic settings, the real atheists are to be found in English literature departments." And that just made me laugh, because it's kind of true. You know, people who are spending all their time looking at the stars, looking at sort of the amazing laws and the consistency actually in creation, all these things, many of them, you know, actually believe in God. They're like, there's too much order here, there's too much rhythm, there has to be a reason for this. There's plenty of stories like that, and I know that Guy Consolmagno, in his book God's Mechanics: How Scientists and Engineers Make Sense of Religion, he talks about, I haven't read the book, but I've read selections of it, and he talked about how he's seen this many times, about scientists who sort of learned their way into belief, because it simply couldn't be ignored. The laws of the universe demanded that. But meanwhile, over in the over in the English department, we're with Camus, we're existentialists, we're like, you know, what is life, what is meaning, we're dissecting the text to death, you know, like, I totally get it, like, it makes total sense to me. But anyway, you know, this sort of merging of science and theology, and it's actually, it's much more natural. And I quoted Pope Benedict there in the beginning, and he, you know, he wrote a lot about this as well, and was very encouraging of, you know, scientific study. He loved astronomy, and that can be like a beautiful expression of understanding God and encountering God. And of course, Dante famously described God as the love that moves the sun and the other stars. That's so beautiful. So we've got a lot to explore here, so I'm just going to launch right into the episode. I'll just give you the quick reminder to find me online at bornofwonder.com. Check out Substack, link in the show notes. I just sent out a monthly musings, which is sort of my philosophical thoughts that have been going around in my head, as well as a bunch of links to good writing around the internet. This month's theme, I really was thinking about, is it good to exist? Because a lot of people don't think it is. So you can go ahead and read that. And of course, contact me anytime, markatkatie@gmail.com. And of course, I'd be thrilled if you consider joining me in Ireland in October. You can find that link in the show notes as well. let's get going here. We're going to, you know, here, use my daughter's sort of unabashed creativity as our imagination here. Is just like we're putting on our rocket suits. Is that a term? Our astronaut suits, the helmet, the whole thing. And like the kids in this story orchestra, we're in our bunk beds and we're taking off. We're going out into space. So here we go.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
So as I said, Gustav Holst, he was a English composer who composed the 7-movement orchestral suite. The Planets, definitely what he is most famous for. And each movement of the suite is named after a planet in the solar system and its supposed astrological character, of course, which is also inspired by sort of Roman and Greek mythology. For which they are named. So here we are, we're flying through space, we're among the stars, and we arrive at Mars, the bringer of war. Music here builds to a quadruple forte and a dissonant climax. Although Mars is often thought to portray the horrors of mechanized warfare, you can kind of hear why people would think that. It was actually completed before the First World War started. The composer Colin Matthews writes that for Holst, Mars would have been an experiment in rhythm and clashing keys, and its violence and performance may have surprised him as much as it galvanized its first audiences. So you can certainly hear that violence here, this sort of intensity, you know, Mars, bringer of war. And as far as planets go, not necessarily the place I would want to visit. Dry, rocky, bitter cold, the fourth planet from the sun. Mars is one of Earth's two closest planetary neighbors, Venus being the other one. One of the easiest planets to spot in the night sky. It looks like a bright red point of light. You've certainly seen it. So it's a cold desert world. The average temperature is minus 85 degrees Fahrenheit, so way below freezing. It's about half the size of Earth, often called the Red Planet, of course. That redness comes from the rusty iron in the ground. It has two moons, and it's the only planet that we, human beings, have sent rovers to. And they drive around Mars taking pictures and measurements, so you can actually see real pictures from Mars. So let's hear a little bit more from Holst's composition here. Okay, so now we have left Mars, we're flying through space, and we are arriving at Venus, the second movement here in Holst's Planets. The second movement begins in Adagio in 4-4, and according to Imogen, I had looked up how to say her name and I've already forgotten it, Imogen Holst, who is Gustav Holst's daughter, Venus has to try and bring the right answer to Mars. Sort of a poetic way to think of it. Venus as the bringer of peace, when we first had Mars, the bringer of war. Venus, of course, is the second planet from the sun, and even though it's not the closest planet to the sun, it is the hottest. It has a thick atmosphere full of greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, clouds made of sulfuric acid, tons of volcanoes just everywhere. It's just a hot, hot place. So we've gone from sort of the cold desert to this sort of terrifying volcanic planet. And here's something really interesting. It confused me to think about. Venus is unusual because it spins the opposite direction of Earth and most other planets, and its rotation is very slow. It takes about 243 Earth days to spin around just once. And because it's so close to the sun, a year goes by very fast. It takes 225 Earth days for Venus to go all the way around the sun. And that means that a day on Venus is a little longer than a year on Venus. That's so confusing. Just goes to show that time, you know, you've seen that movie Interstellar, right? Time bends, I believe it. So now here we go. We are arriving at Mercury, the winged messenger. This movement, the last of the seven to be written, contains Holst's first experiments with bitonality, juxtaposing melodic fragments in B-flat major and E major in a fast-moving scherzo. Solo violin, high-pitched harp, flute, glockenspiel. It's the shortest of the seven movements, only taking between 3.5 and 4 minutes to perform. Mercury is the smallest planet in our solar system, just a little bigger than Earth's moon. Mercury itself, though, doesn't have any moons. Closest planet to the sun, but it is not as hot as Venus. Venus is hotter. So along with Venus, Earth, and Mars, Mercury is one of the rocky planets. It has a solid surface covered with craters. It doesn't have an atmosphere. Instead, it has a thin exosphere made of atoms blasting off the surface by the solar wind and striking meteoroids. This small planet spins around slowly compared to Earth, so one day lasts a long time. It takes 59 Earth days to make one day, or one full rotation, on Mercury. But a year goes by very fast, since it's the closest to the sun. It does a full revolution in just 88 Earth days, so you'd be having a birthday like once every 3 months. do the math on that to see how old you would be in Mercury years, and then you'll feel quite young. Yeah, and so it only has, because it takes so long, the sun takes forever to rise and set, right? So it only has one sunrise every 180 Earth days. Wow. So now we are arriving at Jupiter, the bringer of jollity. In this movement, Holst portrays Jupiter's supposedly characteristic abundance of life and vitality with music that is buoyant and exuberant. Jupiter is the biggest planet in our solar system. It's similar to a star, but it never got massive enough to start burning. It's really fascinating. Covered in swirling cloud stripes, has big storms like the Great Red Spot, which has been going on for hundreds of years. Yeah, isn't there just like a poem in there, like a storm raging for 100 years? It's just crazy. It's a gas giant, doesn't have a solid surface. Still unclear if deeper down it even has a central solid core, we don't know. Has rings, but too too faint for us to really see. One day on Jupiter goes by in just 10 hours, and one year on Jupiter is the same as 11.8 Earth years, and it has 95 officially recognized moons. Now we arrive at Saturn, the bringer of old age. Apparently Saturn was Holst's favorite movement of the suite. Matthews, who we heard from earlier, describes it as a slow processional which rises to a frightening climax before fading away as if into the outer reaches of space. Very ethereal and kind of eerie. So Saturn isn't the only planet to have rings, but it's certainly the most famous for them and has the most beautiful rings. The rings that we can see are made of chunks of ice and rock. And like Jupiter, Saturn is mostly a ball of hydrogen and helium. When Galileo saw Saturn through a telescope in the 1600s, he couldn't quite make out what he was seeing. He didn't understand these rings he was seeing. At first he thought he was looking at three planets, and then he thought he was looking at a planet with handles, but of course we now know that what he was seeing were the rings. So one day on Saturn goes by in just 10.7 hours, and one year on Saturn is the same as 29 Earth years. Now we have arrived at Uranus, the magician. So this is a good description of this music. A clumsy dance which gradually gets more and more out of hand until, with what seems like a magic wand, all is abruptly swept away into the far distance. It is sort of rollicking like that, so sort of like a clumsy dance. Uranus is made of water, methane, and ammonia fluids above a small rocky center. Its atmosphere is made of hydrogen and helium like Jupiter and Saturn, but it also has methane, and that's what makes Uranus blue. The methane makes Uranus blue. It has faint rings. The inner rings are narrow and dark, and the outer rings are brightly colored, and we can actually see them. Like Venus, Uranus rotates in the opposite direction as most other planets, and unlike any other planet, Uranus rotates on its side, so it's sideways all the time. One day on Uranus lasts a little over 17 hours. One year on Uranus is the same as 84 years on Earth. So, you know, before we were at Mercury, we were, you know, having like every 3 months a birthday. Now it's 84 years, so I haven't even made it to my first birthday yet, so still got a lot of time, I think. Now, finally, the last movement of the suite, Neptune, the Mystic. The music of this last movement is quiet throughout, swaying, irregular meter, sort of dissonance going on in this movement. And then as it develops, the orchestra is joined at the end by an offstage female chorus singing a soft, wordless line, and this was very sort of unusual at the time. Then the orchestra falls silent and the unaccompanied voices bring the work to a pianissimo conclusion, uncertain tonality, and the door between the singers and the auditorium is gradually closed. So a very sort of otherworldly ending to this orchestral suite here. Neptune is dark, cold, very windy. It's the last of the planets in our solar system, and it's more than 30 times as far from the sun as Earth. So it's very similar to Uranus, made of thick fog, water, ammonia, and methane over an Earth-sized solid center. Its atmosphere is made of helium, hydrogen, and methane, and that methane is what gives Neptune the blue color, a very rich blue that I always loved. I think that's why it was my favorite planet as a kid. It has 6 rings, but they're very hard to see. One day on Neptune goes by in just 16 hours, but it has such a long journey around the sun that it takes 165 Earth years to go around once. Wow, that's a long year. I wouldn't make it. That would be it. I would never make it to 1 year. It has 16 moons. So that concludes our tour of the planets, brought to us by the composer Gustav Holst. As far as how this music was received, his daughter wrote of the 1918 premiere, "Even those listeners who had studied the score for months were taken aback by the unexpected clamor of Mars. During Jupiter, the charwomen working in the corridors put down their scrubbing brushes and began to dance. In Saturn, the isolated listeners in the dark, half-empty hall felt themselves growing older at every bar. But it was the end of Neptune that was unforgettable, with its hidden chorus of women's voices growing fainter and fainter in the distance, until the imagination knew no difference between sound and silence." Wow. So you can only imagine. I think this would be pretty incredible to see live. If you ever see that your, you know, local symphony hall is putting on a performance, it could be very, very cool to see live. That would be really great. So I'm going to have to wrap it up here. I don't know if you can tell, but I have a very stuffy nose. So I've had to like pause to breathe throughout this. So sorry about that. I'm also drinking some red wine, which is like, I know that's not good for your sinuses, but we had some wine open over the weekend, and my husband's not drinking till after Easter, so I feel like I feel responsible for this wine. What an excuse, right? You have to drink the wine. So, you know, what can I do? You know? Plus, I'm celebrating, right? 100 episodes. So cheers to that. Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to end here with a quote from Madeleine L'Engle, writer of Wrinkle in Time and many other wonderful books, who, of course, was famously a Christian and a lover of science. And I love her sort of outlook here. This is from A Ring of Endless Light. She wrote, "If I'm confused or upset or angry, if I can go out and look at the stars, I'll always almost get back a sense of proportion. It's not that they make me feel insignificant. It's the very opposite. They make me feel that everything matters, be it ever so small, and that there's meaning to life, even when it seems most meaningless." So I hope that's the message you got today. I hope that's the message you get if when you start thinking about the stars and the planets and everything else. And just remember what Dante said is that, you know, God is the love that moves the sun and the other stars and all the planets too. So I'm going to end here with a Les Miserables medley. How's that for random, huh? Well, actually, I was thinking of the song Stars, you know, which is sung by... well, very badly sung by Russell Crowe in the movie, but that is sung by Javert, and it's a beautiful song. I mean, it has a beautiful melody, but as I was sort of looking at performances, I wanted to see if there was maybe an instrumental performance, and I came across this Les Miserables medley by Lindsey Stirling, who you may know is a violinist, sort of a rock violinist. But I really love the medley here, because Les Mis has such beautiful melodies. Yeah, so I love this medley, and ironically, it doesn't contain the stars melody, but I was reading about Lindsey Stirling on Wikipedia, you know how that happens, you find something you like, and you have to read their Wikipedia page, and I read here that Stirling has a celestial body named after her, asteroid 242516 Lindsey Stirling. So there you go. It's about two 2 to 3 kilometers in diameter. Some other very lots of technical terminology that doesn't make any sense to me about how its size and things like that. So anyway, there's an asteroid named for Lindsey Stirling flying through space right now. So even though this doesn't contain the Stars melody, I think it's still appropriate. So you can enjoy this Les Miserables medley. Maybe I'll do an episode on Les Mis soon. I have that sort of in the back of my head as well. I might be taking a little break here. I'm not sure. No promises one way or the other, but not like a lengthy break, but I have some interviews that I want to have time to do, some really fun ones that I'm looking forward to, and I have to have time to prep them and edit them and conduct the interviews, and I need a little more time built in to do that. So it may be another week or two till you hear from me again, but I just sincerely want to thank you so much for listening here on this 100th episode of Born of Wonder. I can't believe that I've made 100 of these episodes. I mean, it has to be a labor of love, right? So I'm just so grateful to do it. I'm so grateful you listen. So thank you so much for that. Enjoy this medley. Enjoy contemplating the stars. And I will talk to you soon. I'm Katie Marquette, and this is Born of Wonder.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
It's a mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.